presenting, and then the last half hour, answering your questions and hearing your rebuttals. The panelists, other than myself, Bruce Fronin, who's an associate professor of law at Ave Maria School of Law in Ann Arbor, and a senior fellow at the Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal. He began his legal career as a resident scholar at the Heritage Foundation and as a senior fellow with Liberty Fund. Spent 5 years as a legislative aide to former U.S. Senator Spencer Abraham before joining the Ave Maria faculty. Among his other distinctions is that he is the author of the well-known volume Virtue and the Promise of Conservative Life, The Legacy of Burke and Tocqueville. Our third speaker is Bradley C.S. Watson, who is holds the McKenna Chair in American and Western Political Thought at St. Vincent College. Dr. Watson is a fellow in politics and culture at the Center for Economic and Policy Education. His teaching areas include political philosophy and American political thought and institutions. He directs the Center's Government and Political Education Lecture Series, its annual Civitas Forum on Principles and Policies for Public Life, and its biennial Cultural and Policy Conference, among his other distinctions. I will lead off, and he will be the cleanup hitter. I took the rather chancy topic of Americanism. When I was a young professor, which hardly anyone supposes I still am, I taught a course entitled Americanism, which was required of all graduates of Louisiana institutions. It was a one-hour course, and if you didn't teach it, state wouldn't give you any money, which is an effective way of getting the attention even of academics. In this heady experience I had, I should have learned then, Americanism was taught to classes of roughly 500 at a time. It was not an essay sort of examination that I gave. And the students, of course, immediately renamed it communism, which shows that they were not without humor even in those days. So since then, I've tried to avoid the term, but here I go again. Americanism, the question of community and politics. Let me begin with the words on the subject from an acknowledged expert, Teddy Roosevelt, who wrote this a bit over a century ago. There is one quality which we must bring to the solution of every problem. That is an intense and fervent Americanism. We shall never be successful over the dangers that confront us. We shall never achieve true greatness, nor reach the lofty ideal which the founders and preservers of our mighty federal republic have set before us unless we are Americans in heart and soul, in spirit and purpose, keenly alive to the responsibility implied in the very name of American, and proud beyond measure of the glorious privilege of bearing it. That was 1894. Times have changed. I shall suggest, however, that it is indeed Americanism that most concisely symbolizes who we are, and shall understand that term as designating the common sense of the country's founding generation, its homonoia, or like-mindedness, in Aristotle's usage, or senso commune in Vico's terminology. This, I think, is the way Thomas Jefferson and John Adams seem to have understood the term when they coined it at the end of the 18th century. This understanding, therefore, appeals both to the old and the new science of politics as denoting a complex matter of fundamental importance. Once the meaning has been clarified a bit, I shall try, by implication at least, to suggest how to meet some of the challenges we face in preserving and defending the convictions and the way of life historically built on Americanism. In this, as in so much else, Plato seems to have shown the way in the Laws when he characterized the process of preserving a just regime as mache athanatos, an undying struggle, a process our American forebears translated by the defiant phrase, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. The heart of the matter, and I acknowledge its most delicate aspect, is to connect Americanism with the biblical faith of Americans as the chief source of its strength and enduring resilience, and of its frequent arousal of anti-American sentiments from ideologues of every stripe, those self-anointed elites at home and abroad, who readily enlighten us and denigrate us at every waking moment of on every conceivable subject. Edmund Burke identified the basis of the American consensus in the dissenting branch of Protestantism. Publius identified Providence's gift of one united people, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, in Federalist II. Tocqueville, who never lies, stressed, one must never forget that religion gave birth to America, and that American Christianity has kept, he said, a strong hold over the minds of the people, not merely as a philosophy examined and accepted, but as an established and irresistible fact which no one seeks to attack or defend. Obviously, times have changed. However, not to be thought merely old hat, Samuel Huntington, just last year, challenged Americans to, quote, recommit themselves to the Anglo-Protestant culture, traditions, and values that have been the source of their liberty, unity, power, prosperity, and moral leadership as a force for good in the world. He forecasts that unlike the 20th, which was defined by contending ideologies, the 21st will be a century marked by the revenge of God, prematurely certified dead by 19th century luminaries, you remember. That is, by the resurgence of religions, with culture and ethnicity replacing ideology as the central terms of reference. Anglo-America was a Bible-based culture for 300 years, Trevelyan observed, finding this stupendous religious movement unlike anything in the annals since St. Augustine. So what are the consequences for Americanism? A great many, of which I mention only two here. First, a theory of human being as created, imago Dei. Each person imperfect and sinful after the fall, yet graced with the defining unique capacity of communion with his Creator, as this is decisively experienced in the new birth, an inward feeling and assurance of election, a process of salvation that runs from conversion and justification toward sanctification in the imitation of Christ, a spiritual movement from ruin to recovery of the divine image as powerfully recounted, for instance, in the soteriology of Isaac Watts and John Wesley during the 18th century revival that we call the Great Awakening. Second, there is a pervasive understanding that the course of human events is providentially guided even as it is effected by human agents, by individuals exercising dominion through reason and volition over the creation as citizens, no less than as pilgrims, living in a collaborative faith-grace relationship with God. In both respects, the tension of the in-between reality of time and history is consciously affirmed and continuously affirmed as structuring immanent as well as transcendent reality in lives. Thus, Lincoln's almost chosen people, more often than not, implies humility rather than hubris, as it has played out in American public affairs. Jingoism and imperialism are excesses, even perversities, some of them tinging current policy debates, as a matter of fact. Of this chosenness rather than authentic expressions of it. The sentiment of feeling chosen, elect through the foreknowledge of God, as we have it in the first verse of 1 Peter, second verse, is an expression of trembling assurance, to be sure, but also one of constant supplication for divine favor, akin to that symbolized in the parable of the prodigal son, who rejects, strays, and returns, seeking mercy in a dynamic of faith, experienced in rebellious apostasy, repentance, forgiveness, and renewed communion, familiar in the prophetic writings of the Old Testament as well as in the Gospel of Luke, where the prodigal son story is told. The keen awareness of this dynamic and the consciousness of American community at the time of the founding is reflected in many sources, but perhaps nowhere more poignantly than in the 16 or more resolutions of the Continental Congress asking for national days of prayer, humiliation, repentance, and thanksgiving at various points in the American Revolution, and intermittently proclaimed thereafter in our history as well. Such a day was proclaimed, it may be recalled, as the very first act of President George W. Bush's presidency in January 2001. The Declaration of Independence is an obvious and primary text for any understanding of Americanism and a concise creedal statement of its meaning. But to be rightly understood, it has to be placed in the Christian context just sketched. The evocation of transcendent divine being and the creator-creaturely relationship and the sense of providential governance of human affairs beyond any sectarian divisions are authoritatively communicated in the Declaration, as is also an anthropology hinting at man as having been created in the divine image and thereby indelibly stamped with liberty, expressed in the rhetorical mode of inalienable rights reflective of the Creator's salient attributes. The Lockean liberal political theory there advanced thus ontologically foots on this anthropology, as demanding consent for legitimacy of laws and of government itself, whose powers are thus inherently limited, and whose cardinal purpose is salus populi, to serve the citizenry and not they it. The Declaration expressed the Whig consensus of the Americans at the time, Jefferson later claimed. Now, I think Jefferson and Adams meant all of this and more even when they coined the term Americanism as early as 1797, which is the first date I see it used in this way. But they also meant the republicanism nurtured in Western political philosophy by the most famous writings of our civilization, from the Israelite Republic of 70 Elders, revived by James Harrington and even quoted by Tom Paine, to Aristotle's mixed regime and rule of law, to Aquinas, whom Lord Acton somehow thought the first Whig, to the Commonwealth men of the English 17th century, especially John Milton and Algernon Sidney, whose language is soaked in biblical and classical understanding. From Richard Hooker by way of Locke, their Americanism embraced the principle that laws they are not which public approbation hath not made so, an insistence that gave the American Revolution its motto, if it had one. And this republicanism, at least it was thought in, by some of the founders, including Madison, was intended to be inculcated by the constitutions and by the laws of the new republic through a habituation to republican ways that would become part of the character of the people through habituation. We may also remember that James Madison himself stayed on an extra term at the College of New Jersey to study Hebrew with John Witherspoon so as to be able to read the Old Testament in the original tongue as he did the New Testament in Koine Greek. This was the golden age of the classics in America, and the educated generation knew the Bible inside out, and the Greek and Latin, especially Tully classics, as they call Cicero, were second nature to them. What emerges, if we take the founding moment as paradigmatic for our purposes, is a body of writing and thought in which faith in divine governance in human affairs is buoyed by a sense of history that teeters uneasily and expectantly on the edge of possible eschatological fulfillment through the second coming of Christ, a tenuous enthusiasm held in check by the obscurity of divine mysteries, one tempered by the rational, watchful waiting that marks the human condition itself with an uncertainty no less than with expectancy, with the end to come like a thief in the night, as is said in the Olivet Discourse. This scripturally grounded common sense rationality Franklin's Poor Richard captured in the maxim, work as if you were to live 100 years, pray as if you were to die tomorrow. The new epoch sense to be possibly dawning was symbolized on the reverse of the Great Seal of the United States in the slogans, the Year of Our Daring, 1776, and the Novus Ordo Seclorum, the new order of ages, of the ages, with the eye of providence presiding over an unfinished pyramid. But not my will, but thine be done, the prayer went. No more than any other positive human achievement might any ecumenic empire ever be merely man's affair. But like every other great truth, this delicate matter too can be vulgarized and deformed by willful sophistry. The fifth great strand of Americanism, along with Bible republicanism, Lockean liberalism, and the classics, is common law constitutionalism. This tradition of liberty mightily evokes the ancient Constitution, Magna Carta, the Petition of Right, Sir John Fortescue's Lancastrian Constitution, as revived 2 centuries later by Sir Edward Cook, whose Crabbed Institutes became the reigning textbook for America's lawyers, as Jefferson attested. With it came a sturdy historical jurisprudence to augment the jurisprudence of divine and Stoic natural law that plays such a key role in cogently justifying departure from the realm of England. When in old age, Adams and Jefferson finally patched up their differences and wrote the great exchange of letters we have from them, Adams neatly identified the sources of unity of mind and spirit, Americanism, that carried the day for the good old cause as Whig liberty and Christianity. He fervently affirmed, writing in 1813, to his old comrade of battles now long past, his fellow Argonaut, as he called Jefferson, quote, "Now I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God, and those principles of liberty are as unalterable as human nature and our terrestrial mundane system." Close quote. Such Americanism, a highly differentiated complex of vital beliefs deeply held, forming the infrastructure of rational politics, adapting and augmenting as exigency demands, has sustained the nation into the present, I would argue. Perhaps it still remains alive and well in the heartland, despite all social amnesia, the educational depredations of ideologues and postmodernists, and the insidious deculturation wreaked by mendacity, neglect, and blissful ignorance. It has certainly structured resolve from time to time, and from time to time been strengthened in moments of crisis and national peril by decisions to fight for what the United States took to be right and in the national interest. Most lately in our just wars, both hot and cold, and against the great tyrannies of the 20th century, and the present war against terrorism. And it inspired by its universalism, both abolitionism and the civil rights revolution of recent memory. Of course, especially by its steady affirmation as cardinal truth of man's tension toward the abiding divine ground of all reality, it has enraged and alienated the alienated and enlightened intellectuals who prefer their own trendy reductionist ideologies, corrupting modern Gnostic variants. Such superior persons derisively sneer at the bucolic quaintness of those, including our founders and notable patriots such as Teddy Roosevelt and perhaps most of the rest of us, who are unable to understand, as they well do, that all things are permitted, that might is right, and that the highest being for man is man himself. Throw in a dash of envy for material success, economic and political preeminence, and you have a recipe for being hated by voluble elites far and wide, at home and abroad. Anti-Americanism is at base a totalizing, if not a totalitarian vision, one French observer recently wrote. And he continues, "The peculiar blindness of fanaticism can be recognized in the way it seizes on a certain behavior of the hated object and sweepingly condemns it, only to condemn with equal fervor the opposite behavior shortly after, or even simultaneously. According to this vision, Americans can do nothing but speak idiocies, make blunders, commit crimes, and they are answerable for all the setbacks, all the injustices, and all the sufferings of the rest of humanity." But that, it seems, may be a subject for another occasion. It's just a little red meat for you before I close. Thank you. Mr. Cronin.